Well, Your Royal Highnesses, just let me say, first of all, how marvellous it is to have this opportunity to talk about a topic that is so important for all of us, but it's also crucial for our children. And so I hope that this afternoon and this evening we'll have a real chance to debate at the level of a country, because these are, by the way, country issues. They're solved at the level of a country. They're not really solved at the level of a city or the level of an organization. They're solved at the level of a country. So I'm thrilled that this is a country conversation about the future of work. But I wanted to start by saying that the future of work is about the future of humans. It's about us, it's about your kids, it's about my children, your children. So I wanted to start by really taking a look at what we know about the future of humans. Because whilst we might not know some things, for example, as Janine told you, I'd written 10 books about the future. But if you go to any of the index and look for the letter P, P being for pandemic, you won't see it there. So there are a lot of unknowables in our life. And actually that makes for excitement, but it also makes it much more difficult. But there are knowables. And what I'd like to share with you first is the three things that we know about the lives of our children, and our own lives, in fact, not just the lives of our children, our own lives. These are the three trends, actually, that I study. The first is, around the world, as countries like yours and like mine and like Japan, a country I know very well, as we industrialize and live better and live more healthily, we live longer. And in fact, it's perfectly possible that your children, my children, will live to be 100 years old. In fact, if you take a look at life expectancy, it has increased by 2 years every decade. So that every decade, we live 2 years longer. At the same time, in developed countries like yours, we've begun to see children less as an asset and more as a liability. So we've had fewer of them. And if you combine living long and having fewer children, you get shrinking populations. I'm going to Tokyo as soon as I finish here, in fact. And the reason for that, of course, is Japan has both the oldest population in the world, but also a shrinking population, shrinking at an enormous rate. Now, you might say, well, this is just an issue for Japan. Well, it's not. Next up is China. And China will actually age faster than Japan. So the question of longevity is both about what happens when you live to 100, but it's also about what happens when countries like ours age. One thing to remind ourselves, of course, is that not every country has the number of children being born has shrunk considerably. And the two countries I'd like us just to remind ourselves here is Nigeria and Egypt. And both in both Nigeria and Egypt, there is massive population growth, astonishing population growth. And for anyone who's been there recently, you'll also see high levels of unemployment of young people. And that's why if we say, as we do, we live in a joined up global world, remind ourselves that whilst in our country we might have fewer young people, there are countries out there, particularly in the African continent, which have large numbers of young people who would love to have a job and who can't get a job. So, you know, this is the first trend I want to speak about. The second is technology, and you've already really heard a little about technology. When we started to think about the impact of technology on work, we predicted a world where machines would destroy jobs. And this was even a decade ago, this was the normal conversation. What we got wrong there was the idea that we thought the unit of analysis was a job. In fact, it's not. And this is, by the way, an important point about the future of work. The unit of analysis is a task. So if you look at the job you do, the job that any of us do, maybe there are 30 tasks in them. And what we now know is that machines, automation in effect, robotics if it's a manual task, AI if it's a cognitive task, are able to substitute for humans. But that still leaves a lot of tasks that only humans can do. And the interesting thing about these tasks is they're the difficult tasks, because if a machine can do it, it's already done. And these tasks that only humans can do tend to have a high content of what you might call human skills, skills like empathy, listening, and also creative skills, skills like, you know, being innovative, thinking about new ways of doing things. Now, I just want you to remember that when you talk about the design of work, because one point to remember about this is that the capability to be innovative and to be creative requires a rested brain. It requires a brain that's had 8 hours sleep, a brain that isn't feeling incredibly anxious, a brain that's not worried about whether they're going to put, you know, food on their children's plate. So as we think about the future of work, we have to think about a future which enables humans to do what machines can't do. And that's the empathy, the creativity, the innovation, and so on. The third thing I look at, and by the way, there's a lot of jobs being created. So the two points I wanted to make on technology is that in most of our jobs, some of it's going to be automated, but there's only one job that's been entirely destroyed by technology, and that's an elevator, the person who sits in an elevator and presses the elevator button. That's the only job in the US list of jobs that's actually been destroyed by a machine, everything else. But there's also massive new digital jobs. What does this mean for our children, our employees, for you? A huge emphasis on upskilling. That means that in the job you do, you get more skillful in the tasks that only humans can do. And an enormous emphasis on reskilling, learning new jobs, particularly jobs which are digital jobs. And I just want to say, from the perspective of governments, most governments around the world are failing in that basic point. They are not upskilling and reskilling at the sort of speed that humans require it, which is why it's so brilliant that we're all together today, because that's an issue we need to think about it. The third point is really about what happens in families. And what's happened in families, and of course you've seen it in the Netherlands, but it's also happening right across the developed world, is that women are working. And not only are they doing jobs where they move in and out of the labor market as they have kids and caring responsibilities, they're also doing professional careers. And that means that as you look at a family, you're not looking at the sort of family that I grew up in, where my dad worked, had a career, and my mum was a carer. You're looking at families where sometimes both people have careers. And that both brings them more opportunities and choices, but it also means that they're under a great deal more pressure. They have the lowest level of discretionary time of any family unit. And if they have young children, and maybe some of you do, then that is an absolute, I can see the people. I can just see the people around with you. I won't ask you to put your hands up, because I know you're all the tired ones. You're all the ones that are looking tired. You're the ones with the four-year-old. Well, that's just the most difficult time, isn't it? You've got your four-year-old, you're both working, and it's the time when promotions happen. So this is very complex as well as we think about the future of work. Let me just say a couple of things about what this means. The first is, it's having an impact on how we think about our life course. So, you know, people of my age, I'm in my late 60s, they basically went through what we might call a three-stage life. And this was, you had full-time education, you had full-time work, and you had full-time education, full-time retirement. And each stage was related to an age. So if you're 18, you're going to be in education. If you're 40, you're going to be working. If you're 60 or 65, you're going to be retired. Now, one thing I didn't tell you about the 100-year life is if you live to 100, you're working until you're between 70 and 80. Now, I can say that because I'm not a politician. This is not an electable. actually, every now and again, the government, my UK government, says to me, could you run a commission, Linda, and tell everybody that they have to retire at 70? And I said, no, that's your job. But actually, that's the truth of it. And that's why it's wonderful, by the way, being an academic, because I can tell you that. Lots of people aren't going to say it, but it's true. If you live to 100, unless you save a lot, and nobody does, you're working until your 70s. And actually, what you're noticing with young people is they sort of get that. And what they're beginning to live is what we might call a multi-stage life, where they're saying, I want to live the life I want to live. You know, I know that I could come in and out of the labor market. Maybe I could start my own business. Maybe I could take 6 months off and travel the world. I love it. The young people in the audience are all nodding at this stage. Yes, I can travel the world. Maybe I can have a portfolio. And what we're beginning to see, and in terms of how you think about human change happens because individuals change. I mean, that's really how human, and you're beginning to see individuals changing. In all the organizations I look at, in the countries that I work with, young people are saying, I want to live a different sort of life. And we might call them snowflakes and say, you know, why aren't you buckling down? But they're actually realizing they're going to live to 100 at a time of astonishing technological change. Theirs is now a marathon. It's not a race anymore. It's not a short race. This is a marathon. So what we're also seeing is a different focus on assets. So, you know, obviously the fundamental asset that each one of us needs is tangible assets, you know, our savings, our pensions, our property, and so on. And that's an enormous help to us. Just as an aside, and I don't know if you have this in the Netherlands at the moment, but the UK, I think you don't. The UK, after COVID, the over 60s have not come back to work. It's a huge, huge problem. And we've been looking in depth about why aren't they coming back to work. There's two reasons why they're not coming back to work. One is, I have property and no mortgage, so I feel as if I'm okay asset-wise. The second reason is, I hate my job. So, you know, we're getting some really important, tangible assets are important, but actually intangible assets are even more important. And the longer you live at a time of disruption, which our children are, which we are, as we think about the future of work, intangible assets become more important. And I want to talk very briefly about three types of intangible assets. The first is productivity. And I've sort of mentioned that already. And by productivity, I mean, do you have the skills that allow you to keep on working? So if you're, you know, 50-year-old, do you still have the skills? There's a big reskilling thing, isn't there? You have to keep on building skills because the world is changing, jobs are changing, digitalization is taking place. The other aspect of productivity, by the way, is also reputation. You know, do people know that you're highly skilled? And also networks. It turns out that networks are incredibly important in work. And the ones that help you with productivity are the networks of other people you can speak to who help you and mentor you. So productivity is crucial. The second is vitality. And that's health, isn't it? And we all know, I don't need to tell you how to stay healthy. I mean, you Dutch know it better than anyone. Just look at you. You're just astonishingly healthy. You need to sleep 8 hours. You need to walk 10,000 steps. You need to eat sensibly. Congratulations. This is a big help. But actually, people are choosing work where they can stay vital. I decided to get healthy after I'd written this book, The 100-Year Life. When I told everybody else they had to work till 70, I thought, God, I'm going to have to do it as well in that case. So I had to get healthy. It turns out it's very time-consuming to get healthy. Have you ever tried to walk 10,000 steps? We did it yesterday. It's very time-consuming. So, you know, being at the other point about vitality, by the way, and it's coming out in so many different ways, I've written extensively about it, is friendship. And this, I think, is, if I had one word about the future, I'd say, think less about technology and think more about friends. Couple of just data points on that. One of the best predictor of whether you stay in your job is, I have a best friend at work. That's the survey item. I have a best friend at work. A colleague of mine at Harvard runs a study that's looked at people right the way through their life. And the question he asks is, as you look at people right through their life, who are the happiest? People who have friends. It's just, and loneliness, by the way, is a killer. Guess who are the loneliest people right now? They're the 16 to 23-year-olds. And of course, COVID has only made this worse. So for me, it's a real push at the moment to talk about community, to talk about networks, to talk about friendships. Because if you're going to work till you're 70, for goodness sake, or 75, and it's lonely, what a terrible life you're creating for people. So how do we do that? And the third is the capacity to transform yourself. We talked just earlier about COVID, and I just want to say something about that. I have said, and I think others have said as well, that this was the biggest change to work since the Industrial Revolution. You know, it completely changed the way that people thought about work. I think in probably a country like yours, you know, you were already thinking that people could work from home, but the country that I know best is Japan. And in Japan, nobody ever worked from home. I mean, you were in the office all the time, 12 hours a day, and it was a huge problem. Japanese companies moved everybody to work entirely from home within 3 days of March the 11th of the COVID. What did we learn? Well, we learned actually that people love flexibility. They absolutely love the fact they don't have to commute, they can work from home. But we also learned it's pretty complicated, primarily because of friendships and networks. And also it's unfair. You know, if you're in an office and you can, you know, work from home, that's great. But my son, my younger son, Dominic, is a radiologist. In fact, during COVID, he was on an accident and emergency ward for the whole of those 2 years. He couldn't work from home. You know, the people who look after this wonderful palace can't work from home. The people who look after our rubbish can't work from home. The people in factories can't. So what we have to also do is to be aware of what's fair. And I think this is, friendships, one word I would say is an important word. The second word I would say is fairness. How do we, in a society like this, where we're thinking at the level of the whole country, not the level of an individual corporation or the level of a family, what is fair across our citizens, I think is a really important point. And I want to finish by saying, you know, it's so important that you're here today. The reason I get involved in the World Economic Forum is it's the only other place I see where you get everybody into a room together. Because the truth is that as you reimagine how it is to lead into the future, it's a multi-stakeholder process. Each one of us plays a role. So, you know, the worker plays a role. So one of the questions I ask my MBA students is, I give them a case, obviously, it's an MBA class, I give them the case, and one of them is of a young factory worker, she's 32 years old, she's got 2 kids, bringing up her kids on her own, she has to upskill. So the question I ask my MBA students is, whose responsibility for that? And well, you know, there is, can she pay for it? How do you motivate her? How do you show her that it's the right thing to do? How do you persuade her that actually spending time upskilling means she's going to get a better paid job? Because that's the reason why most people upskill, by the way, because they get a better paid job. So there's a whole question of signaling to workers, what is the future? Germany is good at this, by the way. How are technologies going to change? There's an incredibly important role for unions to really understand the future of work. And in the UK, they've been very thoughtful about this and not push against these developments, but actually realize that these are inevitable consequences of the demographic and technological choices that I've spoken about. Companies play a really important role. And I know that within the Netherlands, you have some wonderful companies who are doing exactly that, because at the end of the day, it's companies who should be taking the lead in many of these things, both with their own employees, but more importantly with their supply chain. And you know, you within the Netherlands have companies that go into supply chains go right across the world. How can you help those people upskill, reskill, have decent jobs, have flexibility about what work they do? educational institutions like ours, I mean, I'm sort of embarrassed to tell you that we don't do very much for 60-year-olds at London Business School. And we have to stop doing that. We have to realize that lifelong learning is going to be absolutely crucial for all of us. And we in education, one thing I'm really proud of, apart from standing here in front of you, which makes me really proud, is that the book that Andrew Scott and I wrote called The 100-Year Life, in Japan, which was a big book in Japan has now been made into a children's book that goes into the schools for children to read with a whole free resource for teachers to teach children that they're going to live to 100 and what that looks like. So we have, from the school upwards, we have a lot to do to help kids understand the world that they're going to live in. Civil society, of course, if you look at the US, most of the initiatives around the future of work are civil society initiatives. That's not necessarily the case, I know, in Europe, but in the US it's been really important. And of course, government plays a role in terms of how it regulates, how it taxes, how it thinks about showing its employees, showing its citizens what the future is, and also providing some help. So thank you so much for listening to my piece about the future of work. And Janine, back to you. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.